Okay, this is the Cheskel Shir Ilui Nishmos Ephraim Shmuel Ben Avram Arya Kohen, and also Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel HaKohen, Book of Yecheskel. Shir is also dedicated to all our soldiers, as ever, and as the war continues. We're in chapter 16 of Yecheskel, and we're up to verse 13. There's a description, an allegorical description of continuing between the relationship between God, or a generous man who picks up a foundling in the field, which is an allegory to the way God picked up the Jewish people in Egypt. And we got to the point where God has given them the Torah, and they're about to travel through the desert to the promised land. And we'll pick up the story in verse 13, chapter 16, verse 13. And as God says, Vatadi zohar v'chesed, I adorned you with gold and silver. Umal bushech sheish bomeshi v'rikma, and your clothing was fine linen, silk, and embroidered cloth. Soles udavash v'shemen ocholt, and fine flour, honey, and oil you were given to eat. Batifi bima'od ma'od, and you became very beautiful. Batitz l'chilim lucha, and you became fit for the throne. So here we have God now at the point of having given the Torah. God is the husband, the king, with his wife, and he's giving his wife everything she needs. And to the point where she's fit to rule as well, to be a joint ruler. So here, at this point in verse 13, and we'll see in verse 14 as well, the Abravanel and other commentators describe the transformation. This is the point of transformation of the Israelites from desert nomads, which they were for 40 years, to conquerors. They're conquering the land of Israel. And a subsequent consolidation of power in the region, thanks to God, the gift of the husband that was originally the gift giver, the lifesaver of these people, now the husband and the king. So God says in this verse, "Vatadi zov v'chesed, I adorned you, or you were allowed to adorn yourself with gold and silver." This refers to two things. Silver is the written Torah, and the gold is the oral Torah. Now, you notice the idea here is that the written Torah, which is the safer Torah that we have, is described as being silver, whereas the oral Torah is described as being golden. There's an expression in English, silence is golden. But here we have the oral Torah, which is verbal, is described as being golden. The reality is that the oral Torah preceded the written Torah. Not many people think about it in that way, but that's the way it was, that the oral Torah must have preceded the written Torah. That's why the oral Torah is considered to be the golden part of the collection, and the written Torah is really the precy of the oral Torah. The oral Torah is much longer, the oral tradition is much longer, and what the oral Torah does, it transforms the written Torah into gives the ability of those that follow the Torah to create a society. Without the oral Torah, the written Torah would be incapable of impossible to construct a civil society just based on the written Torah. It requires the golden edition of the oral Torah. And again, the oral Torah is much longer. Oral tradition is much longer than the written Torah, the Torah Shebet Sav, the Sefer Torah that we have. So that's why it's described as gold. And the other reference here to gold and silver is, after the sin of the golden calf, God placed the Mishkan, which was made out of gold, that would travel with them through the desert, carrying God's, so to speak, God's presence with them through the desert. And of course, we know the Mishkan was adorned with gold and silver. So that's the idea of zahav or chesed, gold and silver, that the Jewish people, the wife, was adorned with gold and silver. Then it says, Umalbushech sheshu meshi berikma, and your clothing was of fine linen, silk, and embroidered cloth. This is also a description of the Mishkan that traveled with them through the desert, that protected them. And it was adorned, as we know, just had it described to us in the past few parishes. It was adorned with beautiful curtains of linen, colored tapestries, and complex embroidery. The embroidery is so complex that the artisans needed Ruach HaKodesh. They needed divine help to construct everything that was constructed, everything that was all the artistry that was done on the Mishkan. And then he says, Soles and Dvash v'shem and Nochalt. God, so to speak, provided them with fine flour, honey, and oil that the people ate. So we know that during the 40 years in the desert, they were given something to eat. We know it as manna, which could adapt from its floury, sticky, oily appearance into any food you desired. So it had the texture of soles, devash, and shemen. It had the texture of fine flour, honey, and oil. But it could be transformed into anything that you wanted to eat. Of course, the Jews complained about that, but that's another story. But after 40 years, the manna stopped, and God brought them into the land, which he described similarly to the way he's described it here. Eretz zavas chalav dvash, a land flowing with milk and date honey. Now, this land of Canaan that they came to, which was a land flowing with milk and date honey, the Torah actually describes it in more detail, much closer to the description of Yechezkel here in Devarim, right at the end of Devarim, in chapter 32, when God says, Vayochal tenuvas sodai, when you come into the land, then they would eat the produce of the field, meaning soles, Vayinakehu Devash Misela B'shemen Michalomish Tzor, and they would suck honey from the rock, which is Devash, and oil from the crags, the Shemen. That's how poetically the Torah describes it, which is exactly what the Yechezkel is saying here. Soles, Devash, Shemen, fine flour, honey, and oil. When they arrived in the land of Israel, they weren't short of any type of food either, even though the manna stopped. They had they could pick up food immediately. The interesting thing is they arrived in the land of Israel. We know that we just had the yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu, which was on the 7th of Adar, and they waited 30 days. They mourned Moshe Rabbeinu's death for 30 days. And then they crossed over the Jordan River, which meant that they arrived in the land of Israel on the 7th of Nisan, and which was just set six and a half days before Pesach. So they needed to have food. They needed to have food to be prepared for the Yom Tov, and that was provided for them, as God describes here. Soles debash v'shem and ocholt, that when you arrived in the land of Israel, there was food waiting for you. Then God says, Vatipi, Bima'od ma'od, you became very beautiful. And this is a reference to the Jews as they entered the land. They became a new type of people. They were desert nomads for 40 years. Their adaptation to self-government. Remember, all the miracles that took place in the desert stopped as soon as they entered the land of Israel. There was no more manna, as we've just mentioned. There was no more water was not provided for them. There was no more miracles. There were no more clouds. Everything they had to do themselves. But God had arranged everything such that their conquest of the land, their entry into the land, their conquest of the land, all went very smoothly. It took them 7 years to conquer the land. It took them another 7 years to divide the land up, which tells you a lot about the Jewish people, right? That we're having a discussion the other day about the nature of the Jewish people and how they are a warrior race. Now, we weren't a warrior race for 2,000 years. We were dhimmi for 2,000 years, pretty much. whether we're in Muslim countries or in Catholic countries, keep your head down, don't say anything, don't get us into trouble. But the Gemara in Beitza describes the Jewish people as it, the Jewish people are a warrior race. And they came into the land of Canaan, they adapted immediately, they changed from being a ragged, nomadic desert dwellers very quickly into powerful conquerors under Yahushua. They conquered virtually the whole of the land in 7 years. But of course, being Jews, they conquered the land in 7 years, but it took them another 7 years to divide it up. You can imagine, as I had a discussion the other day, you can imagine all the arguments that were going on, who gets what. But God says here, "Vatipi b'ma'od ma'od," you became very beautiful. And b'ma'od ma'od means that, number one, that you had the power, you had the military power to conquer the land. That's b'ma'od. And you also had ma'od, you were following the Torah. But the beginning, the conquest of the land of Israel was all done under Torah law, under Torah legislation, in accordance with the rules of war in Judaism, as the Tzahal are doing today, all under the auspices of Torah law. And then he says, "Vatitzlechi limlucha," and you became fit for throne, for the throne, for monarchy. Eventually, the Jewish people reached the apogee of their development with the establishment of royalty, something we're discussing in the book of Shmuel at the present time, and the establishment of the royal Davidic line in Jerusalem. So the development of the Jewish people came thick and fast. They reached adulthood, they reached maturity, they became a warrior race, they became able to govern themselves, and they reached the apogee of their really of the power of Jewish history with the establishment of King David's rule, which took place approximately 3,000 years ago, starting in Hebron and then culminating in his control over the whole of the land of Israel. David HaMelech expanded the borders north, south, and also east, so that Israel was a force to be reckoned with. It was the most powerful superpower in the area. And then in verse 14, "Vayetze loch shame b'goyim b'yofyeh," your beauty when you fame amongst all the nations. "Ki kolil hu b'hadori asher samti olayeth," but it was perfected through the splendor and majesty that I, God, placed upon you. "N'om Hashem Elokim," declares God. So they, the beauty and the fame of the Jewish people spread. "Vayetze loch," says the pasuk here. "Vayetze loch shame b'goyim b'yofyeh," your beauty would you fame amongst the nations. Which means that after the establishment of the royal Davidic line, there were two generations that represented the zenith of Jewish power and Jewish influence across the known world, something that's never been replicated. As the Malbim explains here in great detail, King David represented the military power of the Davidic kingdom. We know from the Book of Chronicles and Divrei HaYomim, "Vayetzei shem David b'chol ha'aretz." David's name, David's fame, was known throughout the whole of the known world. "V'Hashem nosanes pachto al kol ha'goyim," and the Lord placed the fear of him upon all nations. So although the life of David HaMelech himself was a very tragic affair, a very tragic 70 years, he had never had a moment's peace, nevertheless, the respect and the awe in which he was held by all the other nations of the world was staggering. He created a dynasty that should have survived forever, but we'll see. It started to go downhill pretty quickly. That was the zenith. And he was followed, as the Malbim points out, is again, by his son, King Shlomo. King Shlomo represented not military power, but influence and honor, which is equally important. Military power frightens people. Influence and honor brings people in. And As Divrei Hayomim describes, Levad Me'anshei HaTorim VaSocharim Mevi'im. Aside from that which the visitors and the merchants would bring, people would come from all over the world to see Yerushalayim, the city of Jerusalem, V'chol Malchei Arav V'Pachas Ha'aretz, all the kings of Arabia and the regents of all the lands, Mevi'im Zov V'Chesed L'Shlomo. They would bring gifts of gold and silver to Shlomo HaMelech. So you had these two generations. One represented the military power of the Jewish people, which was international, universal, and also the influence, the honor that was accorded to his kingdom, the Davidic kingdom, under Shlomo HaMelech, who reigned for 40 years in complete and utter peace. There was no war at all during Shlomo's time. All the wars had been completed during David's reign, so that during Shlomo's reign, there was Sheket, there was peace and prosperity and tranquility, to the extent that the Gemara says that, people, there was money in the streets, so people didn't even bother to bend down and pick it up. And the affluence was so great. The sense of security was so great. And Ki kolil hu ba'hadriya shesamti olayach ne'um Hashem Elokim. And God makes it clear that he was perfected. This perfection that existed at the time of David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech, that was through the majesty that God placed upon you. Like, it's not you. You never did that. It wasn't because of you. You followed the right derech, and as a result of that, God produced this empire. Again, something that's never been replicated in Jewish history. The empire of the Davidic kingdom, certainly in the first two generations. The Radak says here, Kol zos hatzlocha hakdola shehoyseloch ba'ela hayomim. All that David and Shlomo achieved, all the great success they had in those days, be'ezrosi, it came with my help, says God. Shayisi at osa ritzoni va'ani gam kein hoyisi mashlito schar lagoyim lo bekochacho va'otzom yadelcho. And because of the fact that you did my will during this period, this 80-year period when David was king, or this 73-year period, David was king in Yerushalayim 33 years, Shlomo HaMelech was king in Yerushalayim for 40 years. During that period, the Jewish people kept the Torah, and God gave them a quid pro quo. And the quid pro quo was that God allowed them to rule over the nations in the region, and they, although they didn't recognize it later, they should have recognized that it wasn't through their own strength and their own power, or their own intellect, that they achieved so much. It's hard for us to imagine exactly how powerful the nation state of Israel was during that first period from about 880 before the Common Era, right through to about 820, 815 before the Common Era. If you think about the power that was exerted by the superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you can start to imagine how powerful the Davidic kingdom was during those years. And that's what God says. You have to remember, Kolil hu bahadrai bahadori asher samti olayach. I was the one that provided that for you. And it was a quid pro quo. You kept the Torah, and you were an indestructible force. But unfortunately, as we're going to see now, by the end of the reign of King Shlomo, Shlomo HaMelech, things were already starting to fall apart. One of the ironies, or the irony of Jewish history, is that after two generations, 80 years of the reigns of King David and Shlomo HaMelech, that were epitomized by the creation of a nation that was based on truth and justice for all, the whole essence of the way David conducted his life as king was tzedek and mishpat, that the rights of all every citizen, David, King David, and King Shlomo and Shlomo HaMelech, took it, every decision they made was based on the rights. The human rights, I don't call it human rights, but the rights of all his citizens. But towards the end of Shlomo HaMelech's reign, the breakdown of those two fundamental elements would finally signal the end of the Jewish control over the land of Israel. And the Medrash Tanchuma in Shoftim, describes that Yerushalayim was praised because of its justice system. As it says in Yechezkel here, Yechezkel says here in verse 14, "By Yetzelah Shem Bagoyim, B'yofiech, your beauty won you fame amongst the nations, Ki Kolil Hu Bahadori, but it was perfected through the splendor and majesty of God." And the splendor and majesty of God meant that the awe of God, the Yiras Hashem, meant that the justice system was incorruptible. And that prevailed during this combined period under King David and under King Solomon, Shlomo and David HaMelech. And the Pasuk says, as the Pasuk says in Shemos, V'dol lo seda b'riba, nor shall you favor someone poor in his lawsuit. The whole essence of the justice system under David and Shlomo was completely incorruptible. And it was again the high point. We say that when we bench the Chodesh, when we bench the new moon, one of the things we say in the middle of it is David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. Why do we mention David HaMelech when we're talking about the moon? So the reality is that the moon reaches its high point, reaches its zenith on the 15th day of the month, and the 15th and the 16th day of the month. And David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech, their generation was the 15th and 16th generation, following the creation of the Jewish people under Abraham. And that was the high point. Just that was the high point of the Jewish people. Just like the moon reaches its high point on the 15th and 16th day of the month, the Jewish people reached their high point that they'd never been able to recapture in the 15th and 16th generation of their existence, the 15th and 16th generation of the Ivrim, of the Hebrews. And the irony of that is that one of the reasons that Yerushalayim was later destroyed was because of the perversion of justice, like Midah keneged Midah. Like while there was an incorruptible justice system in place, and the Jewish people were following the Torah under the direction of King David and King Shlomo HaMelech, and they were invincible. Similarly, or conversely, the reverse is also true, that when that justice system became so perverse, God felt that it had to be destroyed, and with it the kingdom, which will take a few hundred years to do. But this is the turning point. Verse 14 through to verse 15 is the turning point. God has described the rise of the Jewish people from nothing, from a child, a foundling, a baby drowning in its own blood in the field, to the highest point that a nation can achieve, the leaders in the world, the exactly how we're supposed to be viewed by the rest of the world, Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations. That's what it was unto David and Shlomo. They reached that, but of course, at that point, the only way is down. And so God now and Yechezkel describe in the continuing allegory the spiraling betrayal of the wife and the fall of Israel from this point of ultimate power and ultimate respect from both the nations that surrounded it, but also ultimate respect from God himself, to the spiraling betrayal of the Jewish people, the spiraling betrayal of the wife, the spiraling betrayal of the queen. And what we're going to see now from verses 15 to 34 is Jewish history spiraling downhill, out of control, in a progression from one low to the next, until the Jews of both the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Yehuda, which we'll discuss as we go through this, finally hit rock bottom. And the unfaithful wife's behavior, the behavior of the Jewish people, gets worse and worse. So we've hit the high point, and now we're about to spiral down to the lowest point in Jewish history. As God continues in verse 15, "V'tivtachi b'yofiech," but confident in your beauty and your fame, "V'tizni al shemech," and you went astray because of your name. You got too big for your boots. "V'tishpachi est taznusayech," and you lavished your favors, "al kol ha'over," and on every passerby. "Lo yehi," you became anybody's. What exactly is he described, God describing here? And really, this verse gives us the root cause of everything that is to follow. There's after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, the king that took over from him, Shlomo HaMelech's son, after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, the kingdom was taken over by his son Rehoboam, and that signaled the downward spiral. There's a verse in Devarim, again in chapter 32, verse 15, that describes, that predicts exactly what was going to happen to the Jewish people when they reached their apogee, when they reached their highest point. It says, "Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivot." Yeshurun, meaning Israel, became fat and rebelled. Vayivot, and they kicked out. Shomanti avisa kosisa vayitash elaha asahu. And you forsook the God. You became fat with your own opinion of yourself. And you kicked out. You forsook God who made you. Vayinabel tsur yeshuasa. And the mighty rock of your salvation you spurned. And the Gemara in Brochus examines the meaning of the first statement of this verse. Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivot, the Pasuk says. The Yeshurun Israel became fat and they rebelled, they kicked out. Omar Ab Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, Omar Rab Yonas, on the Gemara says. This is in Brochus, Daf Lamed Beis, page 32. Omar Ab Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, Omar Rab Yonas. Rab Shmuel Bar Nachmeni says in the name of Rab Yonas, Minayin shechazak Kodesh Baruch Hu b'hoda lo l'Moshe shenema v'kesef yirbesi lohem v'zov osu labao. That the Gemara asks, where do we know that God ultimately conceded to Moshe that the reason the Jews committed the sin of the golden calf was because of the riches God lavished on Israel, as it says, v'kesef yirbesi lohem v'zov osu labao. I gave them an abundance of silver and gold, which they promptly used for Baal worship. And what the Gemara is getting at there is this. When the Torah says, Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivot, and Yeshurun Israel became fat and kicked out and rebelled, it means that the nation will only truly rebel against its provider, in our case God, when it already has a full stomach. That's the nature of human beings. When you've got a full stomach, so you don't need that. You don't, when you know, when the freezer's full, and the bank account is full, so you don't really need God, right? What do you need God for? And you book your cruise around the world cruise, and you got tons of money, and everything's going great. So what do you need God for? So that's what it means by Yishman Yeshurun Vayivot. It's really God's fault in this sense. God, so to speak, spoiled us. He gave us everything we wanted. But the problem is, when you give a child everything they want, or you give your wife everything she wants, so there's always a chance that when a person has a full stomach and got everything they need, everything's going their way, that's when people begin to believe that the success has come as a result of their own greatness, their own intellect, their own skill, their own power. And the Torah warns us about this. And you'll say in your heart, this is from Devarim, chapter 8. This is a prediction of the truth. This is the prediction of the true future of the Jewish people described in the Torah. And you'll say to yourself in your heart, my strength, my might, my intelligence, my brains has accumulated everything, this wealth, this power for me. And that's what it means by Yishman Yeshurun Vayivot. Moshe warned God that if you give the Jews, you know, you give the Jews gold and silver, so they'll build a golden calf. Right? My father used to have an expression, is treat them like a dog and they'll be faithful. Right? It's a bit politically incorrect nowadays to say something like that. But yeah, I mean, the truth is, the more you spoil the child, the more likely he is to rebel against you. And maybe God spoiled us. That isn't to excuse the behavior of the Jewish people that's going to be prevalent in Jewish history, as we're going to see. We're going to review it now. But the reality is that's how people are. What do you need God for? The old story with the parking space. You plead with God for a parking space, and then you find one. You tell God, you know, never mind, I found it myself. And when you're in the when you're in the foxhole, when you're in the trenches in the First World War, so you're appealing to God. But when you're living in Palm Beach and you got 100 million in the bank and everything's going sweet, everything's going wonderful, so what do you need God for? So this is the problem. That was the problem. After 80 years in which first David HaMelech and then Shlomo HaMelech built an empire that was militarily untouchable in the region, it was economically affluent and at peace, a country that was the envy of all the surrounding nations. He had a city with the great wonder of the ancient world, the first temple, where Jew and non-Jew alike would journey to pay homage and be awed by both the temple and the city of Jerusalem. After all these accomplishments, if you look at human nature and how we are, it was not surprising that the people in the land of Israel started to believe in their own publicity. As Yechezkel points out here, he says quite clearly, "Vativ techi b'yofyeich," you became confident in your own beauty and your own fame. Meaning you looked in the mirror at yourself and you saw how great you had become. But you failed to recognize the figure standing behind you in the mirror image. God, the one who had made all this success possible. So if you look in the mirror, if you're looking at yourself in the mirror, there's two ways of doing it. You can look in the mirror from the perspective of just to see how wonderful you are. There's another way of looking in the mirror to see what your faults are. And this is something the Ramchal talks about in Masilis Shesharim, that everyone should make a cheshbon ha-nefesh every day, not once a week, not once a year. Every day, before you go to bed at night, look at yourself in the mirror. What have I achieved today? And how did I achieve it? Who helped me? Was it me? Did I make this deal? You know, am I the architect of my own success, or is somebody out there helping me? So when you're poor and you need and you want and you haven't got, so you're appealing to God. But the temptation is when you've got everything, when you've succeeded, when you're a military power and you're affluent and everything's going your way and everyone is talking about how wonderful you are and the temple and Yerushalayim and the wonderful Jewish people. So you start to believe your own publicity. What do you need God for at that point? So Batizni al Shmeich, you went astray because of that. You went astray because of your name. Because of how famous you became. Look at the narcissism of our pop stars, our sports, the people we look up to in sports, the actors. Look at the Oscars from a few weeks ago. Look at the award ceremonies at these sporting events at the end of the year. And just look at the narcissism that's on show. People are so obsessed with their own talent and their own abilities and their own achievements that they fail to recognize that where it's all come from. And that's Batizni al Shemeach. You went astray because you started to believe in your own name. It was you. The Malbim says here, Batizni al Shemeach, Rotzaloma, Tichila, Lozanisa. At the start of this downhill spiral, the Jews didn't prostitute themselves. They didn't indulge in Avodah Zarah. They weren't interested in trying out new things. Adain ba'atzmachal reik zonisa al shemech ma'ashikosav rochav b'shma zinso. They merely advertised. They boasted. Everyone that came to Jerusalem, they advertised how wonderful they were. Boasted. They had, like in Times Square, they had posters up and on the backs of buses, the wonderful Jews, the miraculous Jews, the fantastic Jews. They boasted about their accomplishments to all their neighbors. They invited them to Israel for cross-cultural discussions in order to, this is the Malbim, in order to gloat about their greatness. And says the Malbim, this is similar to the status of the beautiful prostitute Rocha, who's described in the Gemara in Megillah. And the Gemara in Megillah describes the prostitute Rochav. The prostitute Rochav was Rochav, it was a prostitute. She lived in the land of she lived in Jericho, in Jericho. It turns out that she was a very good person, but she was a prostitute. The Gemara describes her as thus. This is the Gemara in Megillah on Daf Tes Vav Amud Aleph. Tana Rabbanan. We learn like this in a Tosefta, like this. Arba Nashim Yafifiyos Hayu Ba'olam. There were four women, the most beautiful women that ever lived. Sarah, Abigail, Rachab, and Esther. So Sarah, the wife of Abraham, Abigail was the wife of David HaMelech, and she was she was a prophetess. Rachab, this prostitute. And Esther, that's why it's from the Gemara in Megillah, because it's Esther. So the Gemara says, Rochav bishmo zinsa. Rochav was so beautiful that she aroused impure thoughts just by the mentioning of her name. The mere mention of her name would fill men with lust for her. And the Gemara says, and the Mefarshim now say on the Gemara, Rochav was a magnet of lust for potentially unfaithful men. It was not something she encouraged. It was just something that was part of her look, her makeup. And what the Malbim is saying here is that by inviting the neighboring nations into Israel to socialize with them, so the Jews could show off, the Jews were inviting in a beautiful prostitute. They're inviting in a culture that should have appeared to them to be base and immoral. But the culture they allowed to enter into Israel, they were mysteriously attracted to it, just like men were mysteriously attracted to this prostitute Rachab. They just couldn't understand the lust that she engendered. And this was the status of the Jewish people. They wanted more. They were greedy. They had the culture, they were from, but they wanted more. So they allowed to enter into the land of Israel mysteriously attractive culture. It was new, it was exciting. Something they couldn't resist, something they wanted to try, something they wanted to copy, something they wanted to emulate. Just like Rachel was irresistible to any man who saw her. The Jewish people couldn't get enough. They'd achieved everything they were supposed to achieve, but it wasn't enough. They wanted more. They wanted another culture. They wanted to learn about other societies. And this is the start of the downhill. As the Pasuk says, "Vatishbichi es tzunasayich al kol over," this Pasuk says, you lavished your favors on every passerby, meaning you became so enamored with the culture and the freestyle life of the pagans that came to visit you. As the Malbim says here, "Bo eris bo eish had shu kol aznus," the fire of lust for fornication burnt inside of you. You wanted to experience, you wanted to taste the pagan lifestyle that they had. They came and visited Yerushalayim. You were enclosed. You had a society that was running perfectly, an incorruptible justice system. You had a marriage, children, education. Everybody was religious. Everybody kept the Torah. There was no crime in Yerushalayim. But you invited all these nations in. You wanted to know about them. But of course, once you let the genie out of the bottle, you can never put it back in. And they invited all these nations in, and they came in with their different cultures, their cultures based on sex and what we would call sex and drugs and rock and roll today. But free for all, everything's okay, nothing's wrong. And that's society, essentially the society we live in today. Nothing is wrong. It's just it's all about perspective. There's no moral objectivity. There's no moral compass. Whatever you believe you are, or whatever you believe you should be doing, as long as it doesn't affect somebody else in the sense that you're not damaging or killing or stealing from somebody, whatever you want to believe, whatever you want to do, whatever path you want to tread, it's all, everything is equally valued and equally valuable and equally acceptable. Any way of life is equally acceptable. That's what they invited in. They invited in the woke crowd into Jerusalem. And you wanted, says the Malbim, you wanted to experience and taste the pagan lifestyle that they had. But once you've tasted that lifestyle, the Yetzer Hara gets a hold of you. And that was the start, as the verse ends with the strange words. Now, there's a lot been written about the last two words of this verse. Lo Yehi, you became anybody's. So I'll just tell you what it really boils down to. That once you, Lo Yehi, once you got the taste of the pagan lifestyle, there was no stopping you. Like you were like a kid left alone in a candy store. There were so many neighboring pagan nations, each with their own peculiar, unique Avodah Zorah, pagan lifestyle, immoral lifestyle, sexual perversions, etc., etc. And each of these pagan lifestyles had aspects that promised different exciting ceremonies, sexual misadventure, and you wanted to try them all. You wanted to try them all on. You wanted to try everything. Lo Yehi, like a child in a candy store. So you did. And that was the start. As the Pasuk continues, verse 16. Vatikhi migodayich vatasiloch bomos teluyos. And you took your clothes and you made yourself piles of colored garments. Vatizni alecha. And you fornicated on them. Lo boos v'lo yiyah. This should not have happened, nor should it ever happen. And again, the allegory here is clear, that you invited the foreign, the pagan nations, the Assyrians, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Philistines. You wanted them all to see you. But instead of learning from you, you learned from them. You invited them into the country. You wanted to make them and their culture feel welcome at home in Israel, exactly the way we do here as well. That's what we do here in Israel as well. We want everyone to feel at home. The president of Israel, a week before the 7th, or 2 weeks before the 7th of October, when he was in the United States, told the president of the United States, boasted to the president of the United States, that the biggest, one of the biggest gay parades in the world is in Jerusalem. Well, that's it. That's it. Wonderful. Everything's okay. Forget about the Torah. Forget about why you're here. Forget about why this land is yours. This land is yours because of the Torah, no other reason. It says so in the first Rashi in the Torah. Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve'es ha-aretz. It's God's world. God created this world. Right? He splits it up the way he wants to. He owns it. The real estate all belongs to him. And if he wants to give the land of Israel to the Jews, so it belongs to them. But he kicked the Philistines out. He kicked the Canaanites out. And he kicked them out because of their behavior. And so, you know, you get the president of Israel. We return to the land of Israel, telling the world, boasting to the world, that the most wonderful gay parade in the world is in Yerushalayim. So maybe you shouldn't be surprised that God had a sense of humor failure at that statement. And here, the Radak says here, regarding the way that the Jews, the Israelites at this particular period in history, going into the period after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, when Yerushalayim was really the center of world attention, as it still is today. The Radak says here, Batikhi, you took your clothes, Derech Hazona, Liyafus, Beiso, Laharbos, Bibgodim, Noim, Bibigdei Tzivonim, Limshoch, Leif, Hazonim, Likonis, Bebeiso. It's the prostitute's way to enhance her boudoir, decorating it with beautiful multicolored clothes to attract the attention of the prospective client and tempt them to enter the house or into the brothel to commit adultery, to commit immorality. Vatikhi, you took your clothes. Vatikhi mibgodayich, you took the clothes that God gave you. Vatati loch bomos tuluos, and you made them into colored garments. Vatizni alehem, everything that God gave you, you turned into a bed for prostitution. Upirosh, says the Radak. Upirosh, bomos tuluyos. You piled your coverings, your bedspreads. Alsisa tuloyim ibgodim rechubim amarubin zel zeh ad shenasim ehem bomos va'osim abegodim heim mitzavonim shonim zeh mizeh kadei shiyeh mariyeh yofer. You piled your bedspreads. You mounted and stacked them on top of each other until they were made into a raised area like a bed. And you made it look beautiful for your guests so you could have relations with them. Ve'inyan ha'moshu shahoyu osim beis Yisrael bomos la'akum. And the parable is that the house of Israel would perform in front of these pagans different novel interpretations of their own idol worship. V'zu shona mizu. Betavnisa uba'avodasa. The Jewish people, they're very innovative. So they took the styles and the pagan lifestyle and the pagan customs of the nations around them, and they took them a step further to fascinate their guests. The Jews will do it. The Jews are the same as everybody else, only more so. So when the Jew gets hold of something and he likes it, so he becomes obsessed with it. So they were practicing paganism and all sorts of nonsense. The Philistines and the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Assyrians and the Babylonians, they had all their own deities and all their own perversions. We took them all and adopted them all and pushed the boat out further. And we built it up and built it up, as the Pasuk says here. You built bomos. You built it. You piled it up. You added to it. You made it even worse than it was to start off with. You created the new improved paganism of your neighbors. You were doing this. The only thing to be said in your favor, says the Malbim, is that you were still doing it privately. It wasn't public. There was no national movement of Avodah Zarah. There was no national movement of paganism. It was all done behind closed doors. People didn't want other people to know at this stage what they were doing. They were inviting these cultures in, and people were doing business and those cross-cultural meetings and everything else. And Jewish people, the Israelites, were adopting these types of behavior, but they were doing it in private at this stage, says the Malbim. That's not going to last for very long. Eventually, it's going to come out into the public arena. It's going to become the law of the land or the custom of the land. It says, lo bomos lo ye, at the end of the pasuk says. It says this shouldn't have happened, and it should, and nor should it ever happen, because this was clause number 1 and 2 in the marriage contract on Mount Sinai. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Number one, monotheism. I am the Lord your God. That was the first clause you signed on to. No other gods, no paganism. And the second clause, the second part of the marriage contract, lo yieh lecha elohim acherim al ponai. And the words al ponai are very important here. You shouldn't have any other gods al ponai. Like, and you're doing it in my face. You're in my land. You're using everything I gave you to worship other gods, to worship paganism, to take part in these abominable behaviors of all the other nations around you, and you're expanding on it. You're doing it better than they are, which is what the Jews do. They take an idea that, you know, a goy has an idea, the Jew will, you know, drive it off the cliff, create an empire out of it. Lo yeh lecha elohim acherim al ponai. You were doing it in my face. God's face is on the land of Israel. It would be bad enough if you were converting to Christianity, to Catholicism, you know, in 13th century France. That would be bad enough. But here you are in the land of Israel. You got everything you want. I've provided everything you want. I've given you everything, affluence, power, peace, everything. And al panai, in my face, you're doing it. So this is not a good sign. The only thing to be said in their favor at this point in Jewish history is, again, that they weren't doing it publicly. They still had some shame left. But the shame they had left is soon going to leave them. The Jewish people are still are pretty soon going to be, dispensed with their shame. And it's all going to be out in the open. As we start, verse 17. Vatichi klei tifarteich, and you took the vessels of your glory. Mizavai umikasbi asher nosati loch. You took the gold, my gold, says God, and my silver, which I gave to you, my wedding present to you. And you made yourself images. You made yourself golden and silver images, and you fornicated with them. You had sexual relations with them. That doesn't mean literally sexual relations, as we'll see. But you get the picture here. So now all of a sudden it's starting to get, you can see the downward spiral. God says, you took everything I gave you, my gold, my silver. God starts to make the point that will be continued through the ensuing verses, that everything you used to beautify your own idols, the paganism that you adopted, the idols that you worshipped, and the pagan lifestyle that you adopted, everything, all the materiel, everything that you used to create your pagan society, you used gifts that I gave you, that God gave you. What a chutzpah! You took the gifts of your husband that your husband had given you, and use them to lavish gifts and initiate sexual encounters with your lover, your idols. But again, it's still in the privacy of the Israelites' own home, because the Israelites were still a little embarrassed at this stage. And we're moving through Jewish history. We're going to get to the point of after the split of the kingdom, things start to become even worse than they are now. Things start to take place in public, but they were still a little embarrassed about it. But the chutzpah of it, the chutzpah to use a gift from your husband, to pay for use your husband's credit card to pay for the hotel room that you're going to use to commit adultery with your lover. And God's looking. It's not like your husband can't, in the case of a husband being cheated upon by his wife, so he's, out of sight, out of mind. So what he doesn't know can't hurt him for the time being. But you're dealing with God here. Al ponai. You're doing it in front of my eyes. And God's letting you do it. God's standing back. He's not doing anything. He's allowing you to use everything that he's given you to betray him. So the Malbim here describes the era that God talks about here. This is the era. You took the vessels of glory, my gold and my silver. You made male idols with which to commit adultery. The imagery is here of someone who has not yet committed actual adultery with another man. Only with a figure or an icon that represents a man. Meaning, shelo zonsa adayim begilui, rak betzina ala korim she'asasom in abigadim. You had not yet openly fornicated. I mean, you had not yet. It hadn't become the institution of paganism. Hadn't become the institution of the land of Israel yet. It was still done modestly on the pillows that she made of her own clothes in her own house, as described in the above verse. Lo al gav baroma baruchovus kamoshi yoma achaza. Israel hadn't yet got to the point where they constructed idols in the public domain on every street corner, on every street corners, and worshipped and fornicated with them in the streets. That's going to happen much later, and is going to be described in the coming verses. V'chol zeh moshel, alo avodah zorah she'avdu mimei rechavam ad yimei ochos. This verse is specifically dealing and describing an era in the southern kingdom of Yehuda between the death of Shlomo HaMelech, when his son Rehoboam became king, unto the monarchy of King Ahaz, a period of 200 years, embracing a period of 12 kings of Yehuda, when paganism slowly crept into Yehuda. But during that period, says the Malbim, the pagan practice was strictly a private affair, not public policy. But Sire, she'osad slolim min bigdei tifarto, and the imagery painted by Yechezkel is that their avodah zorah, their paganism, wasn't exclusive. Meaning, they were schizophrenic. They created a hybrid religion during this 200-year period. They'd embraced Judaism, but they'd also embrace Abdu Havodah Sa'ela, Gamke. But, they go to shul in the morning, put the tefillin on, and then in the afternoon and evening, they go to an orgy, celebrating the bow. She yirtsa bom v'shiyia ke'ein emsa b'inom l'bein Hashem. They would even start to believe that this was something that God approved of. That, everything goes. Everything's fine. Yeah, you can be a frum Jew, and you can also, you can also worship the Baal. You can have a Jewish state, and you can have a gay parade in Yerushalayim. Where's the contradiction? They rationalized it. And they were worshiping God. And they said, we can worship God's intermediaries as well. We can worship the Baal. We can worship Ashtaroth. We can do it all. The sun, everything. Why not? It's all the same. And it became schizophrenic. Guys putting tefillin on the morning and going to the orgy in the afternoon. Abel Bazer, his chisa big day tifaratum. What they didn't realize, as the Malbim, was that they were desecrating every gift they'd received from God. Everything. Everything they had came from God. They started off as they'd forgotten, as an abandoned baby child drowning in its own birth blood in a field. But now they're the big kanakis, right? They're controlling the world. They're indestructible. They're affluent. They've done everything. They've achieved everything, and they've done it all themselves. Yes, we'll thank God in the morning. We'll get up and we'll put tefillin on and we'll say thank God. But we live in a modern age. Everything's okay. Multiculturalism. There's nothing wrong with their religion. We'll join it with our religion. The mitzvahs they were doing, the Torah they were learning. Lo boaz lo yiyeh. The previous verse stipulated. This hybrid religion was not Judaism. It's not the Judaism they signed up for on Mount Sinai, nor should it ever be. Lo boaz v'lo yiyeh. That is not Judaism. Judaism is what you signed up for on Mount Sinai. And the Pasuk says, the Pasuk finishes off, v'atas l'chot tzal mizocha v'tizni bom. You made male images. You took God's gold and silver, and you made images. And you thought, that's okay. That's fine. You made the male images and you fornicated with them. And again, the Radak Mashiach Avatasach Lot Salmi Zocha, who the Indian Hamalitza Kedera Chazonos, Shaosa Salmi Zachoris Ladover Hatashmish. As the allegory here is of the Israelites being compared to prostitutes. The verse describes the statues and the idols they made, all in the masculine form. For it's the way of the prostitutes to adorn their brothels with the images of aroused naked men, readying themselves to fornicate. They do this in order to seduce their customers and clients. Like, get ready. You're going to have a great time here. And that's what the Jewish people were up to. So that's where we are. We started off at the high point in this year, the high point of going through the desert, the warrior nation, the conquerors, the keepers of the Torah, the keepers of the Brith, the rise of the Davidic kingdom, the peace and prosperity of the period of Shlomo HaMelech, the building of the temple, the high point, David Melech Chai V'Kayom, the moon. The Jewish people are compared to the moon, but now the moon's starting to wane. After the 15th and 16th generation, David and Shlomo HaMelech, so in the 15th day of the month, and 16th day of the month, so the moon's at its highest point, at its zenith. But then it can only go down. It can only start to wane. And that's what's happening now. Slowly but surely, the moon, the Jewish people, are starting to wane. And the next few verses are not easy to read because they describe exactly the Jewish people, their fall from grace, and eventually it'll describe the forthcoming destruction of Jerusalem. So that's where we're going to end off today. It's a beautifully crafted allegory, as you can see. It's not me that's doing it. It's the language of the prophet, the language of God, speaking through this verse and describing how he feels. How would you feel? How would you feel as a husband or a wife if this was happening? How does God feel? I'll just repeat again something that, the question is asked, who's the most tragic figure in Jewish history, in the most tragic figure in the Tanakh? So everyone says, Moshe Rabbeinu is a tragic figure. He wasn't allowed to go into the land of Israel. David HaMelech's a tragic figure. Many tragic figures in the Tanakh. But the real tragedy and the most tragic figure in the Tanakh is God. God's the giver, and everybody lets him down. Everybody lets him down. So God's describing how let down he feels here. And this is going to continue as we move into verse 18, which will be, please God, next Tuesday. There's some questions, next Monday, sorry. Some questions here. One is from David Barrett. You generally place kings of Dol and Shlomo on the same level of perfection, but surely the downhill, which you've been stressing, started with Shlomo, multiple wives, idolatry, related to Melachim 1. Yes, possibly. You could be right there. Slight correction, although not changing your meaning. President Herzl praised the gay parade in Tel Aviv. Was it Tel Aviv, not Yerushalayim? Okay, whatever it was, it wasn't to our, I can tell you, it wasn't to our benefit upstairs, whatever it was. In any event, that's where we're up to. We'll pick up, please God, next Monday, same time, same place. Verse 18, it's not pleasant reading for the next, till we get to verse 35. But it's Jewish history that we have to review, as we'll see how how private paganism became public policy, and how eventually the Jews actually hit rock bottom. All will be revealed, please God, same time, same place, in health and happiness, next Monday. I wish everybody a Freilich Purim. There's a Rav that wrote that we should downgrade the celebration of Purim this year. I completely disagree with that sentiment. The whole essence of Judaism is to, God has given us the ability to mix a tragedy with joy, and which is why, cleverly, in my opinion, the day of remembrance of our soldiers is the day before is the day before Yom HaTzimut. And we've got the ability, the Jewish people, because of our history, have got the ability to combine those to process those two emotions. The emotions of tragedy, the emotions of the destruction, of how people want to destroy us, with the joy of understanding that God will always be there and help us out. So this idea of reducing the Adelo Yoda of Purim this year, I think, is just not appropriate. Not appropriate. Okay.
Thanks, Harry.
Peace. Kol Tov to everybody. Have a great week and have a great Purim. I'll see you next Monday.
Thank you.
Harry, see you later.
Yeah, Kol Tov. Kol Tov.
Thanks.